Hey there, and welcome to Hacker News Daily, a podcast from Bree. I'm Mia.
And I'm Milo. Today, we're covering some really interesting stories from tech and beyond. There's a lot to get through, so let's jump into the rundown.
First up, with Doge winding down, serious questions are being raised about what happened to its records, its data, and the whole institutional memory of that effort.
We also have a big data story about a graph that some are arguing deserves to be front page news, plus the destruction of climate.gov and how open data initiatives stepped in to save critical climate information.
In the tools and community space, there's a fascinating roundup of ShowHN projects, including a neural network written entirely in SQL and a project related to the satirical political figure Count Binface.
We'll also look at a benchmark of 15 old, discarded GPUs running modern workloads and a compelling report from a TFTP honeypot that reveals some real-world attack patterns.
And for retro computing fans, we've got the art and engineering behind Philpede for the Sega 400 and a technical feat that brings Linux to the Sega 32X console. Stay with us.
Ingement fully inspires to mything me speak course 378. If it stops up this trips, and I am a posicto for position manifest to get across, it lovely put the D.2 5 milliliters over 2. Think, without his ICX literally granting around everything, because expite that I dusting is an authent riesting decision, and the orn the narrative doricating as a varia to be getting one burning struction why believing, when I alas this ord siege, to specively see how instangible of that position nation remaining together here, spelieve yaster chanter. I am a good literary, what is clug, and what believe. This is a reg of slog can seek, despectively tolic and working laws, that slowly pick this first bought to report troom. Swikes down from the butzers, I am completely want to tell we wit me, to Siberia bubble alphabetically.
And that was only one facet of his work. He also starred as Alastair Stewart opposite Holly Hunter in Jane Campion's Oscar-winning film The Piano, a performance that was as restrained as it was emotionally devastating. On television, a whole new generation saw him as the cold, calculating Chief Inspector Campbell in Peaky Blinders, a late-career turn that reminded everyone just how much menace he could bring with a quiet line delivery.
The range is what stands out when you scan his filmography. He could anchor a family adventure like Jurassic Park, then walk into the psychological dread of Event Horizon, then pivot to the historical fantasy of the Merlin miniseries. That versatility, combined with a calm and commanding screen presence, means his legacy isn't tied to a single hit. It's in the sheer width of material he elevated simply by being in it.
A career like that becomes a kind of shared memory. For millions of people, their first encounter with wonder on screen, or their first real scare, or their first introduction to complex historical drama, had Sam Neill's face at the center of it. The Guardian confirmed his passing, and what follows now is the long reassessment that always comes after a figure this steady leaves the stage.
Shifting to a different kind of disruption. Telegram's URL shortener domain, 2.m, has been suspended, and the immediate effect is that every short link on the platform is broken. Whether the link pointed to a channel, a specific public post, a user profile, or an external site, clicking it right now leads nowhere.
This is not a minor inconvenience. The 10.m domain is the connective tissue for discovery on Telegram. Public invite links, forwarded messages that contain shortened URLs, entire bot-powered notification systems, they all relied on that domain to route traffic. Right now, all of that plumbing is frozen.
And the strangest part is the silence around the cause. Wii's lookups confirm the domain is not resolving, but nobody has stepped forward to explain why. It could be a registrar enforcement action, a court order, a government request tied to content moderation, a contractual breach, or even a missed renewal during a custody transfer. The entity behind the suspension and the legal grounds remained undisclosed.
That vacuum leaves everyone guessing. If it is a targeted takedown over specific channels or posts, that raises one set of questions about regulatory pressure. If it is an administrative error with the .me country code domain, that is an entirely different failure mode. Telegram itself has not published a statement clarifying the origin.
Operationally, the company has fallback domains. It already controls telegram.me, telegram.org, and telesco.pa, so it could regenerate functional shortlinks under a new prefix if needed. But the larger lesson here is how brittle a platform's distribution layer becomes when it funnels everything through a single, externally governed namespace. Until the suspension is lifted, or a replacement is lied, the core mechanics of sharing on Telegram are simply off.
A privacy ultimatum is landing inside the Samsung Health app, and the choice it presents users is stark. An in-app notice states that if you do not consent to Samsung using your health data for AI training, the company will delete that data from your account.
We are talking about years of deeply personal metrics. Exercise logs, sleep patterns, heart rate readings, weight trends, all of the wellness tracking someone has accumulated inside the Samsung ecosystem, gone unless they say yes to having it ingested by an AI model.
Samsung frames this as part of its Galaxy AI push, integrating generative features into the health platform. But the mechanism is what legal experts flag as problematic. Data protection laws like the GDPR require consent to be freely given and specific. Bundling a data deletion threat with an opt-out looks a lot like coercion, forcing users to trade long-term privacy for immediate access to their own history.
And the unknowns pile up. Samsung has not clarified exactly how the AI models will use that health data, what safeguards are in place, or whether anonymization even occurs before training. The silence leaves open the possibility that sensitive biometric and behavioral profiles could feed into commercial AI products far beyond simple fitness recommendations.
For the users staring at that pop-up, the situation is even worse. There appears to be no built-in option to export data before deletion, which means the lock-in is complete. You either surrender your information for algorithmic training, or you watch it be erased with no transitional off-ramp. The episode crystallizes a growing tension between the data hunger of AI development and the foundational principles of informed consent.
When the Department of Government Efficiency wrapped up its work, the question that lingered was not just about what it achieved, but what happened to its records. Doge, heavily tied to Elon Musk, pursued sweeping job cuts and efficiency mandates. Yet its closure left a fog around whether institutional memory was properly preserved.
The Freedom of Information Act is the obvious retrieval tool, but FOIA works at a deliberate, bureaucratic pace, and DOGE operated rapidly and often informally. There is real concern that key decisions were made through ephemeral channels, signal messages, verbal conversations, that inherently resist formal record keeping.
That creates a specific risk. Without a proactive archiving standard, the internal justifications for specific personnel cuts and the methodologies used to identify waste could simply vanish. Observers are asking what repository now holds DOGE documents, and so far officials have not publicly detailed it, leaving oversight bodies guessing about compliance with the Federal Records Act.
The downstream consequence is a potential accountability gap. If the records are incomplete or scattered, reconstructing DOGE's exact impact and validating its claimed savings becomes extremely difficult. Watchdog groups are likely preparing FOIA litigation to force disclosure, and any formal congressional inquiry demanding a catalog of archived materials will be a key signal to watch in the weeks ahead.
There is a data visualization circulating that deserves far more attention than it has received, and it concerns sea surface temperatures in the equatorial Pacific. Gregory Andrews, a former Australian climate ambassador, published a chart on his site, Lyrebird Dreaming, that plots every year since 9,982 inches blue, with 2025 drawn in red.
The red line is what stops you. It has detached completely from the historical bounds, setting a record that is not merely incremental. This is a wholesale departure from the climate system's familiar range, and the speed and shape of that divergence are what make the chart so unsettling.
Andrews used publicly available NOAA data, and the methodology is straightforward, which makes the lack of rigorous editorial attention from major media puzzling. The story is not just that 2025 is a record warm anomaly. It is that the signal challenges assumptions about the predictability of the El Niño-Southern Oscillation cycle and about the rate at which underlying ocean heating can manifest.
The question now is, what happens next? The signals to monitor are whether this pattern persists into the autumn, how it interacts with emerging atmospheric circulation trends, and how peer-reviewed climate modeling interprets the break. A graph this stark demands a response, and so far, the silence from legacy outlets is notable.
When the Trump administration slashed NOAA's budget, one of the casualties was climate.gov, the government's primary portal for public climate data. But a small team refused to let that information disappear. Former NOAA staffer Rebecca Lindsay, her sister Mary Lindsay, and ex-colleague Anna Eshelman decided to rebuild the resource themselves.
The new site is climate.us, and its existence is a testament to open data principles. The underlying environmental datasets were publicly archived, which meant the trio could reconstruct over 15 years of vital climate records outside of government control. Temperature trends, atmospheric data, everything that had been abruptly cut off is now accessible again.
Jenna Barnes reported the story at the 19th, and the signal it sends is significant. Open data infrastructure functions as a last line of defense when federal science faces political disruption. The raw information outlasts the administration that tried to take it offline.
It is also a story about personal commitment. Three people, two of them sisters and one a former colleague, looked at a broken public resource and decided to stand it back up themselves. The lesson for anyone who depends on government-hosted data is that public archives, distributed backups, and the willingness to act independently are not abstract virtues. They are what allows critical information to survive.
The Los Angeles Police Department has let its contract with the surveillance company Flock expire, and it cited serious concerns over civil liberties and privacy as the reason. Flock operates a nationwide network of automated license plate readers that track vehicle movements in real time and retain that data for later searches.
For one of the country's largest police forces to walk away from a system it had used to investigate stolen cars and violent crimes, that is a significant shift. Civil rights advocates have warned for years that persistent, warrantless location tracking enables dragnet surveillance of entire neighborhoods and chills free expression.
The department must now evaluate alternative tools or fall back to more targeted investigative methods, while other cities with active Flock contracts face renewed pressure to scrutinize their own oversight and data retention rules. The key signal to track next is whether LAPD releases an internal privacy impact assessment.
And beyond Los Angeles, the decision could ripple through California's broader regulatory landscape. The state has been tightening rules around automated recognition systems, and when a major police force voluntarily steps back from a vendor, it gives other agencies a concrete precedent to examine. The expiration of this contract is not just a local procurement event. It is a data point in a much larger debate about where the line between public safety and mass surveillance gets drawn.
A fackling uptable analogy that it intended today our spectism time to between the visis crowding of your CFO tural eye able faculation. Our final story is a collision between developer skepticism and AI industry hype, and it centers on Andrew Kelly, the creator of the Zig programming language. Kelly has publicly called out Anthropic over what he describes as misleading marketing for its Spade tool, which the company promotes as an automated code correction system.
Kelly examined the claims and concluded they are significantly exaggerated, amounting to vaporware rather than genuine capability. He argued that the demonstrations Anthropic has shown rely on staged, cherry-picked examples that do not represent real-world software engineering complexity, and that the tool fails on the kind of systems-level programming where Zig itself excels.
This critique lands at a sensitive moment. Anthropic has raised $132 billion in investment and is reportedly approaching a trillion-dollar IPO valuation, a trajectory that depends heavily on the narrative that AI is about to automate most coding and eventually other forms of labor. Kelly's challenge is a concrete test. Either provide reproducible, rigorous evidence that Spade works beyond scripted scenarios, or expect more engineers to publicly question the company's story.
The tension here reflects a broader frustration in parts of the developer community. Seasoned engineers see a widening gap between the polished demos aimed at executives and the messy reality of maintaining large code bases. Kelly's intervention is not just about one tool. It is a demand for the industry to close the distance between the promise and the product. And right now, that distance looks substantial.
Apple released a new on-device speech API called Speech Analyzer, and the team behind the Inscribe app just published the first real benchmark against it.
Right, and what they found is pretty striking. They tested it on over 5,500 utterances from the Libre Speech dataset, and Speech Analyzer beat every locally shipped Whisper model, including Whisper Small, on both the clean and the noisy subsets.
Not only that, it ran roughly 3 times faster than Whisper Small. That is a meaningful speed boost for an on-device engine.
The comparison that really tells the story, though, is against the older SFS Speech Recogniter API, which Speech Analyzer replaces. That older API came in last on clean speech, trailing even the 40-megabyte Whisper Tiny model.
So the jump from the old Apple stack to the new one is enormous, and it even surpasses the industry-standard open-source competitor in accuracy.
Exactly. And for developers, that means a faster, more accurate option that runs entirely on the device with no cloud dependency.
Separately, there is a fascinating piece of research about the real cost of frontier models. A developer named Ruslan Ianberdin ran an experiment with identical TypeScript code, and the bill on Anthropic's Claude was 73% higher than on OpenAI's GPT.
And that is despite what the per-token pricing pages would lead you to believe. The difference comes entirely from the tokenizer, not the sticker price.
So given the same human-readable code, Claude's tokenizer splits it into more tokens than GPT's tokenizer does. Multiply that larger token count by the per-token rate, and the final bill inflates significantly.
Ianberdin argues the standard dollars per million tokens metric is broken for direct model-to-model cost comparison because tokenization algorithms vary so widely across providers.
For developers running large-scale inference on structured inputs like source code, the cheapest model on the pricing page can actually be the most expensive in practice. That is a hidden multiplier that only shows up at scale.
Shifting to platform design, a California bill now threatens the infinite scroll. SFGate is reporting on proposed legislation that targets features designed to encourage endless engagement without natural stopping points.
The argument from legislators and advocates is that the pattern hooks users, especially minors, into compulsive consumption. You simply lose track of time.
For platforms like Meta, this would mean pressure to redesign fundamental user experience patterns. The infinite scroll underpins metrics like session length and ad impressions.
And SFGate is calling the infinite scroll endangered if this bill passes. The outcome in California could set a national precedent, forcing tech companies to adopt paginated or time-bounded interfaces instead.
It is a direct challenge to one of the most pervasive design patterns on the modern web.
Let's revisit a landmark case. Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard exposed how elite admissions operate as a sorting machine. The evidence showed applicants are funneled into lanes with starkly different odds before a file is even fully read.
Recruited athletes, legacies, and donor-linked candidates get much wider gates. For an unhooked domestic applicant with no such tie, the opening shrinks to a pinhole.
The trial revealed that a domestic student at a given academic percentile now has a far smaller chance of landing a seat and of paying for it than an identical student 50 years ago. The seats are zero-sum and have been redirected.
The case also documented Harvard's use of race as a factor in a way the court ultimately found unlawful, while showing how non-academic hooks systematically alter who gets accepted.
It is a rare window into the machinery behind those admissions decisions.
On the enterprise side, Microsoft researchers have published a study on Archive about the company's early 2026 rollout of command-line AI coding agents. And what is notable is it was a dual-track deployment.
They simultaneously rolled out Anthropic's Claude Code and GitHub Copilot 151. That signals a deliberate parallel strategy, not a winner-take-all bet.
Microsoft is effectively testing how a model from outside its ecosystem, Claude, behaves inside its developer workflow alongside its own first-party tool.
The paper examines who tried each tool, who continued using them, and crucially, whether the output justified the cost. It aims to close the gap between organizational deployment decisions and real-world telemetry from a large engineering environment.
And as of early July 2026, the full paper is available on Archive.
Here's a story for thrifty builders. Old Tesla data center GPUs are surging into the secondhand market. We are talking about a 24GB K80 for $60, a 16GB P100 for $75, and a 16GB V100 for under $200.
A developer known as EssaLogic ran a year-long benchmark project testing 15 of these decommissioned cards against modern workloads. The question was whether all that idle VRAM is still useful.
The results show even the aging K80 can serve memory-hungry inference and batch processing tasks when raw speed is secondary. Meanwhile, the V100 remains a capable accelerator for contemporary AI and compute jobs.
There are downsides, of course. Higher power draw, missing instruction sets, and cooling complexity. But the performance per dollar often beats new consumer cards for workloads that fit within the available VRAM.
The author's message is that hobbyists should not be afraid of these enterprise cast-offs, provided they max the workload to each generation's limits.
In a nostalgic but technically impressive project, the classic Linux 0.11 kernel has been rewritten in idiomatic Rust, and it boots successfully inside QAMI emulation.
The repository is called Linux 0.11 ARS, and it demonstrates how Rust systems' programming capabilities can target a historic kernel originally written in C.
The effort shows fully functional boot behavior in emulation, and it has drawn attention from the Hacker News community. There is even a QEMI-ready image available as a demo artifact in the repository.
It is a lovely intersection of retro computing and modern language safety.
Finally, a developer known as Ketonulu has managed to boot Linux on the Sega 32X console. This was an add-on for the Sega Genesis that was never designed to run a full operating system.
The biggest technical hurdle was the 32X's complete lack of hardware synchronization primitives, which would normally be essential for managing its two Hitachi ST processors in symmetric multiprocessors.
And yet, the Linux port specifically targets that dual CPU architecture and works around the missing hardware using purely software-based synchronization. The kernel and a small root file system fit within a very limited memory map.
The project builds on earlier efforts like Linux on the Atari Jaguar and the Linux MD project, and it has already drawn coverage from Hackaday and Tom's Hardware. The author has published full configuration files for anyone who wants to replicate the setup.
Who needs hardware synchronization primitives anyway, right? That closes out our topics for now.
Some incredible ingenuity across the board today.
Tabor at Lash. Today we're looking at a piece by Fabian Sanglard that digs into the engineering tricks behind Silpedid on the Sega 400. The Sega 400 add-on had a huge storage advantage, 640 megabytes on a disk, which was about 320 times the size of a typical cartridge at the time. but it came with brutal trade-offs, an 800-millisecond access time, and a data transfer rate capped at just 150 kilobytes per second.
Right, so you had all that space, but you couldn't actually stream complex game data in real time the way a cartridge could. To work around that, GameArts pre-rendered the 3D polygon backgrounds on a silicon graphics workstation and stored them as compressed video right on the disk. The game then plays that full motion video as the background, while the Genesis hardware overlays the player's ship, the enemies, and the projectiles as real-time sprites.
And that combination created this convincing illusion of a high-end polygonal game on a system that simply could not generate those visuals natively. What makes it even more notable is the context. The Sega 400 became infamous for low-quality FMV titles, but PhilPid blended video and live gameplay so seamlessly that it stood out as the console's technical high point.
Separately, there's an interesting development in retro computing preservation. A developer known as Schley has released an open-source replica of the Beavis Ultrasound plug-and-play ISA sound card. The whole project is published on GitHub with schematics, a bill of materials, and Gerber files, everything someone would need to manufacture and assemble their own board.
And for anyone who isn't deep into vintage PC hardware, the Beavis Ultrasound was a clone of the Gravis Ultrasound, a wavetable synthesis card from the early 1990s. Retro computing enthusiasts value it for its distinctive sound and unusually low CPU usage compared to other cards of the era. Schley's replica specifically reproduces the plug-and-play variant, which is a big deal because it simplifies configuration in older systems that originally relied on physical jumpers.
This effort really reflects a broader commitment in the retro community to preserving obscure audio hardware through accurate, buildable replicas rather than just software emulation. The card itself remains a specialized interest. It's most relevant if you're restoring a period-correct DOS gaming machine, but the fact that the designs are out there and open means that hardware won't simply disappear.
Shifting to a different kind of investigation, a researcher set up a TFTP honeypot on a $5 a month VPS and a home Dell server to see what would show up. Over more than a month, they captured 20 to 50 packets a day, hitting port 69. And what they found was both revealing and a little disappointing.
The initial excitement faded pretty quickly once they realized that nearly all the traffic came from scheduled scans run by 7 identifiable InfoSec companies. Shadow Servers, for example, was sending 5 error packets roughly every 11 seconds. Those included code 4 for bad file name, code 0 for access violation, and even a malformed code 4 with extra bytes.
So most of what looked like malicious activity was actually just automated reconnaissance. The remaining unscheduled traffic is the more interesting part. It offers a narrow but real window into opportunistic or misdirected TFTP probes. The researcher notes that ongoing monitoring could help separate accidental queries from genuine exploitation attempts, especially if the honeypot starts returning believable file responses.
Moving on to developer tools, there's an argument from Lalit Maganti that an experimental Git feature deserves a lot more attention than it's getting. The command is git history, and it arrived in Git version 2.54 and 2.55 with 3 new subcommands: reword, split, and fixup.
The problem it solves is that familiar pain of juggling branches and running interactive rebases where one mistake can leave your tree in a half-broken state and your work scattered. Maganti points out that he has tried alternative tools, like JJ every 3 months for a year and a half, and he still comes back to Git. The new command attracted notice with each release, but it remains underused, overshadowed by those JJ discussions, even though it offers a native and safer path for managing parallel changes.
So the pitch is that Git history lets you clean up and organize your work without the risk of a full interactive rebase, and for anyone who writes a lot of commits in parallel, That workflow improvement is significant.
Cloudflare has introduced a new bot detection tool called Precursor, and it's designed to identify what they call agentic behavior, actions being taken by software agents rather than people. The way it works is by gathering continuous client-side signals from the end user's browser, things like mouse movements, device orientation, and details about the browser environment itself.
So instead of relying on a static fingerprint or a single challenge, it builds a behavioral profile for each session and then applies machine learning to spot anomalies and automation patterns that traditional methods can miss. The core problem they're targeting is that escalating cat-and-mouse game where attackers constantly adapt to avoid static detections.
By embedding the detection logic within Cloudflare's Edge network, which already analyzes over a trillion daily requests, Precursor can correlate those rich client signals with massive-scale traffic analysis. The goal is to make faster and more accurate decisions without adding latency or friction for legitimate users. For developers and security teams, this promises a more invisible defense layer and could mean less reliance on disruptive CAPTCHAs over time.
There's a provocative piece from developer Scott Wilsey that pushes back hard on the common complaints about Xcode, specifically that it's terrible for vibe coding. His argument is that you don't need Xcode at all. You can build and ship Mac and iOS apps entirely from the command line and never open the IDE once.
The key is setting up command line build and distribution workflows that use Apple's underlying toolchain directly. Once the initial configuration is done, you can point AI coding tools like Claude Code at those scripts and let the 1000 handle the heavy lifting. The approach leans on Xcode build, code signing automation, and archiving commands that produce App Store-ready binaries.
The result is a faster, more scriptable AI-augmented development loop. It sidesteps Xcode's interface entirely while still producing valid, distributable Apple platform apps. So, if the IDE is the bottleneck, the message here is that you can simply route around it and treat Xcode as optional.
There's a fascinating handwriting proposal from a blogger who looked at why writing in Russian can feel more fluid than writing in English and landed on a specific culprit: backtracking. English cursive forces you to constantly go back to dot your I's and cross your T's, and each of those interruptions creates a mental cue that breaks the flow.
The idea is called backtrack-free cursive, and it reimags English letter forms so the pen never retraces its path. The goal is to preserve the connected aesthetic of cursive while eliminating that primary source of friction. The creator argues that those frequent pauses are what make English handwriting slower and less fluid, and by redesigning the script to avoid them entirely, it could benefit anyone who writes by hand regularly or struggles with cursive fluency.
And finally, a travel story that offers a slightly less intense sequel. Terence Eden, who previously did a 5,000-kilometer, 10-country interrail sprint with his wife, came back for a more measured 7-week trip. This time, they bought a 15-travel-day first-class pass during a December sale and covered nearly 6,400 kilometers through 13 countries.
The key difference was the deliberate decision to ease the intensity. The earlier trip was a sprint, and this one was paced. He titled the post, "Another Ridiculous Intratrail Holiday," and it spans about 2,000 words with a map tracing the full route. The takeaway he shares is that a 2-month pass with flexible travel days beats the old unlimited month grind, letting you enjoy the journey instead of just racing through it.
Welcome back. I'm Mia.
And I'm Milo. This next piece from 12 Grams of Carbon makes the case that success might not matter much if you aren't doing what you love.
The author, Dihura, frames it around founder market fit being necessary but not sufficient. You still have to ask whether the work itself fulfills you.
Right. It's a reflective essay pushing against the standard startup metric that your company's valuation or exit defines your life's meaning.
The core argument is that personal fulfillment trumps conventional success. You can hit every external milestone and still feel hollow if the day-to-day passion is missing.
And that resonates beyond startups. The piece invites you to measure a meaningful life by the quality of your engagement, not by the scoreboard. Something to sit with.
Absolutely.
Separately, there's a fascinating BBC piece about an English woman who sketched India before photography took hold.
Emily Eden. She accompanied her brother, Lord Auckland, when he served as Governor General from 1836 to 1842.
What's striking is the level of detail in her work. One 1844 watercolor from Shimla shows a family thought to be from Ladakh.
And you can identify them as Himalayan traders by their dress and jewelry. They crossed mountain passes each summer, and she captured that with real precision.
Her drawings document everyday people with a curiosity that predates the camera's eye in colonial India. It's a rare visual record.
It reframes her not just as a traveler's sister, but as an intentional artist, creating a historic archive before photography became widespread.
This weekend, Show HN Projects bring some clever music and AI hacks. First, something that runs entirely in the browser.
It's called Voice into Notation. You sing into the mic, and pitch detection with a metronome grid converts your voice into printable sheet music.
It exports as music XML or SVG, and you can set clef, key, and tempo. The fundamental frequency gets drawn against staff positions in real time.
Then there's a different approach for guitarists. The YouTube Guitar Tab Parser downloads a lesson video, samples frames, and uses Claude's vision model to locate the tab region.
It crops every frame to that region, deduplicates by bar's number, and stitches them into a downloadable PDF. The creator says standard transcription services never worked well enough, so he took this simpler path.
Smart. And for hardware fun, there's Bill AI Bass, which revives the classic Big Mouth Billy Bass animatronic, driving it with Strand's AI agents so the fish responds with speech and movement.
More Show HN projects centered on developer tools and privacy. Hackney compares real-time prices and wait times across Uber, Lyft, Waymo, Tesla Robotaxi, Curb, and Empower.
The key detail is that it sends network requests directly from your phone using your locally stored ride-hailing account tokens, so credentials never leave your device.
Once you see the aggregated options, it deep links you into the chosen provider's app with the route pre-filled. The creator reverse-engineered the mobile APIs to make it work.
Then there's Nobi, a free Mac-only Excel-compatible runtime. It works purely with XLX files, calculates formulas with exact fidelity, and never sends your data off device.
It keeps Windows Excel key bindings and lets you optionally plug in AI models like Claude or Codex, but the core promise is local only with no proprietary formats.
Also in the batch, DomDoc Arx converts HTML into native editable Word documents right in the browser under an MIT license. And Clock hands coding agents disposable Linux VMs instead of exposing your real machine.
The through line here is clear. Build tools that respect local execution, format interoperability, and user privacy.
The quirky side of the maker spectrum is alive too. One ShowHN demo implemented a neural network entirely in SQL.
The creator was on his Babylon in Corfu, and used Claude code to prototype a proof that any n-dimensional array can map to a two-dimensional tabular model using his library, ESArraySQL.
It's a conceptual stunt, but it proves the premise that common geo and climate queries are secretly relational.
Meanwhile, the satirical intergalactic candidate Count Beanface launched a campaign site for Makerfield.
It includes a 2026 manifesto, a campaign song, a printable poster, and some pointed taunts toward Nigel Farage. He's previously drawn a salute from London Mayor Sadiq Khan and a mention at Prime Minister's Questions. Chuckle, it's performance politics meets web development, and the Hacker News crowd clearly enjoyed it.
Finally, a web-based experience called Densha recreates Tokyo as a living voxel city running in sync with Japan's real clock, weather, and seasons.
You ride the Jajanodet loop line through this miniature world while a lo-fi soundtrack plays and N5-level Japanese sentences are read aloud, drifting by as subtitles.
It's an ambient study room you just press play on. The creator released it at givis.com/densa, and it drew positive attention on Hacker News.
Commenters did note that the moving backgrounds make the text hard to read, especially with low-contrast building lights at night.
But several people said it rekindled rusty language skills, particularly for those who still recognize kana but struggle with kanji. It's a charming blend of art, place, and learning.
That brings us to the end of today's show. We covered a lot of ground, from the legacy of actor Sam Neill and the suspension of Telegram's TDEM.me domain to Samsung Health's controversial data deletion notice and questions swirling around Doge Records as it winds down. We also touched on major tech stories like the LAPD letting its flock surveillance contract expire and the ongoing debate over the true costs of frontier AI models. Until next time, I'm Mia.
And I'm Milo. A special thanks to the open data initiatives that saved critical climate information when climate.gov was destroyed, and to the developers keeping retro tech alive, from a Linux 0.11 Rust rewrite to a new Beavis Ultrasound sound card replica. We'll have links to all these stories and the remarkable Show HN projects in the show notes. Talk to you soon.